Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Joel Cherney. Today I will be speaking with Catherine Russell, professor of cinema at Concordia University, about her book, Archivology, Walter Benjamin and Archival Film Practices. The book was published in 2018 by Duke University Press. Catherine describes archivology as the reuse and repurposing of archival sound and moving images. We discuss German philosopher Walter Benjamin and his related writing on her concepts, as well as specific films that are useful examples. Welcome, Catherine Russell.
Hey, Joel.
So we're talking about your book, Archivology, Walter Benjamin and Archival Film Practices. Obviously, we're going to talk in depth about the book, but before we do that, I always like to give listeners a better idea of the person they're hearing about, you know, your background. I know you teach film studies in Canada, so give everybody a chance to get more information about you, including anything else you've written, if there's anything specific you want to point people to. So that would be great to start with.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about this book. I really appreciate it. So this is actually the fifth book that I've written, and it actually harks back to a publication that came out in 1999 called Experimental Ethnography. And that book was, the subtitle is The Work of Film in the Age of Video. And in that book, I was dealing with experimental film and its convergence with ethnographic film and anthropology. So that was in 1999. And then I kind of stepped away from that body of work and wrote two books on Japanese cinema. One of them is called Naruse Mikio, New Women of the Silent Screen. And that was a publication with Duke University Press on a Japanese director who made women's films throughout the 20th century, basically. And then I wrote a second book on Japanese film and about the masterpieces of Japanese film, Kurosawa, Naruse, Ozu, Ichikawa, but from a cultural studies point of view, from a women's point of view as well. And then I thought I wanted to go back to writing about experimental film, which I had kind of left since 1999, partly because people were beginning to read experimental ethnography, and it seemed to be very relevant to what independent filmmakers are doing today. And one chapter of that book, Experimental Ethnography, was called Archival Apocalypse. And I had a very pessimistic view of found footage filmmaking at that time. I was sort of looking at it as the end of history. Found footage filmmaking has been around for a very long time, but I was not certain what its potential was for cultural studies, for anthropology, for thinking about culture and identities and so on. And since that time, a lot has changed in my thinking about found footage films and also in its role in culture. And I think it has a lot to do with new technologies that have made recycling film a very much part of our everyday lives, a part of mainstream culture in terms of YouTube mashups and so on. And I wanted to go back to that question I had about found footage filmmaking and the way that independent filmmakers were using it, which I now understood better as being a way of creating new knowledge about history, and that filmmakers have the tools to bring film history alive and accessible. And so that's what motivated this new book. And throughout this process, I've been teaching, and it's really, I think, fortunate that I am able to teach in a film studies program where we have graduate classes in film studies. And so I've been teaching PhD students, and I often work out my ideas in the classroom. And so I do thank them in the introduction of my book for their patience and their contributions to thinking. But I think it's, for me, the best way, when you get a certain kind of problematic like that, to show the films in that I'm interested in the class, and get the responses of students and their input, and also read through the material, read through these Benjamin texts together with students, and kind of brainstorm what they can mean for film studies. So that's kind of the context of this particular book.
Okay. And your PhD from New York University, what was your area of study?
Well, that was a long time ago, and I produced a book actually from that work, which is called Narrative Mortality, Death, Closure, and New Wave Cinemas, which was published by University of Minnesota Press. And that is about New Wave Cinemas and a little bit of like Fritz Lang. It's around the question of why do films end with death? So I have an interest, a longstanding interest in narrative and narrative film. And that's, my career tends to go back and forth. And so the Naruse book I mentioned before, Japanese cinema, that's all narrative cinema. And I'm interested in questions of narrativity and its relationship to culture and society and political history. But I'm also interested in experimental film, non-narrative film. And so my publishing career tends to bounce back and forth between these two interests. And funnily enough, there's a way in which one of the concepts that's introduced in the new book, Archivology, is called critical cinephilia. And with the idea of critical cinephilia is that many filmmakers are going back to Hollywood films and classic cinema in general and breaking it up into pieces to create new insights into film history. So my cinephiliac interest in classical cinema is now kind of converging finally with my interest in non-narrative experimental film.
Well, it sounds like this has been a long, I mean, it's good that, as you point out, that you're in a position where, as in your teaching or, you know, your work with PhD students, that you've been able to continually work within your ideas and work them out. So, yes, I think your students definitely deserve the credit you give them, because you get immediate feedback for something like that. Sometimes when you write a book, or even if you're writing a journal article or a paper, even for a conference, until you actually present it, you don't get feedback that helps. And in this case, you definitely seem to be getting some help with that. So let's define the word archivology. Obviously, the book, you've used it, from reading through some things, it's not a new term for you. I mean, you've used it in a couple of places already, but this is where you're really putting your ideas together. The name sort of, it's pretty obvious from the word archivology, just simple English, that the word archive is very important, and the ology part sort of puts it together, use of archive, that kind of thing. But for your purposes, how would you discuss the idea of what archivology is?
Well, it's a good question. I don't know if I ever actually offer a concrete definition. I think it's something of an open term that perhaps other people might find useful. For me, it is precisely the idea of using archives, filmmakers using film archives, but more precisely as a kind of a language. In which pieces of films, other films made in the past, can be recombined to create new films, which have new insights into history, create new effects, which is something that's been going on for a long time. Found footage filmmakers have been doing this since, the first example in my book is 1936, with Joseph Cornell's film Rose Hobart. But I'm interested in thinking about this process as having something to do with the film archive, and making it legible is one of the Benjaminian terms that recurs throughout this book. And that's one of the concepts of his that I like. And he means by this something to do with the fact that maybe some texts were not completely legible in their own day. And with the benefit of hindsight, from our perspective, given our particular critical moment in the year 2018, we get new insights. We see new things in old films. They become legible in new ways. Which is also to say that films have more than one meaning. We know that. But the idea of legibility has to do with reading and textuality and language. And so I'm thinking about filmmakers who take apart old films, put them together to create new meanings, new knowledge. I think this is in keeping with other work that's going on in cultural studies these days, having to do with affect and the senses, and the idea that there's many forms of knowledge, that they're not all knowledge is reducible to a set of facts or a set of data, but knowledge can have a sensory component to it. And of course, film, whether it's fiction film or documentary film, has the ability to capture something of the sensory environment of the past. Obviously, it's the senses of hearing and senses of sight, but you also get a larger, more amorphous sense of the past and its sensibilities in film history. And I'm talking about all film history, including fiction alongside documentary.
Yeah, I would think that if I was thinking of the term, just in general, without any reading in advance, I would think most likely of documentaries. But as you point out, it's not just; it can also be a narrative, and of course, experimental films. That these kind of things can be used, or kind of thing can be done, and so, but I can also understand how the concepts are not new as far as use is concerned. It's just a different, more complexity involved in reviewing how this all can come together.
Right. Exactly.
So the person who actually, like I say, is mentioned in the title and obviously is the focus in many ways, Walter Benjamin. Now, I know he's German, so I'm assuming we're using the anglicized version of his name. I hope I haven't spent all this time talking about somebody with and I'm pronouncing incorrectly based on what you're used to. But he's somebody I know you've written about before in other formats, but who was he? And give us a little bit of background. I know there's a lot, so I'm not expecting you to read the entire book, but just to give us a little bit of understanding of how he fits into your ideas.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. We would need a couple of hours really to get a handle on Walter Benjamin. I say Walter Benjamin, but perfectly okay to say Benjamin. It's just habit that I say Benjamin. He was a writer, theorist. He was one of the first cultural studies writers, theorists, who did most of his writing through the 1920s and 30s in Europe. His biography is really fascinating. He traveled a lot. He was in exile after 1933. He grew up in Berlin and then was really kind of a migrant in Europe throughout the 1930s. He never worked in a university, although he did do a doctoral degree. So it's a very complicated story why he didn't get an academic job, but he didn't. Walter Benjamin had to support himself during the 1920s and 30s, basically as a freelance writer and critic, which meant that he wrote a lot of essays, a lot, and large, long essays, very dense philosophical essays, as well as film reviews. He did radio broadcasts. He wrote diaries. He was a voracious writer. And he wrote about quite a large number of things. And he was one of the founding figures of the Frankfurt School, which were a group of philosophers who were very influenced by Marxism, but also understood that politics and aesthetics go together, and you need to study them together and think about them together. And not the aesthetic realm was not independent of the political realm. And this was very much where Benjamin is coming from. But he was not like a consistent sort of philosopher type. And for that reason, he's had a very checkered, troubled trajectory in terms of where he fits within the academia today. Philosophers have a little bit of a hard time with him, and he's sort of mostly appreciated by people in literary studies and film studies and media studies. And in fact, I found that he's even most appreciated by artists and filmmakers because he himself was as much a poet as he was a philosopher. He was very, very, inspired and acknowledged that he was inspired by the surrealists. And so he doubles back on himself a lot. He contradicts himself. And the other thing is that history was changing as he was writing. So it's made him very difficult to really get a handle on because his ideas changed as film became more clearly part of the fascist enterprise, and some of his really utopian ideas about film vanished before his eyes as it became a propaganda tool for the fascists. And so he's very interesting in the way that he embraces ambivalence. He thinks about ambivalence, how images and films can be produced for one reason, but read in another way. That we really need to do this a lot of the time because mainstream film is an instrument of capital, and so it's the obligation of the avant-garde to brush history against the grain and think against some of the tendencies of the way that film is used. At the same time, the funny thing is he didn't write a lot about film. He wrote more about literature. He wrote about theater. He wrote about many things. My work was very much enhanced and helped by the work of Miriam Hansen. She's a film scholar who passed away just a few years ago. And her last text before she passed away was a very important analysis of Benjamin's writings on film. She also wrote about Adorno and Krakauer, who were two contemporaries of Benjamin and colleagues. Because she is she speaks German, and she was able to go into the complexity of Benjamin's writing, which is another thing, reading him in English, we're somewhat at a disadvantage. Anyway, she tried to get at really what he meant. And so I do rely on her work a lot. But at the same time, Benjamin's writing is open that it lends itself to many interpretations. So I'm kind of like not necessarily disagreeing with her, but I think taking a slightly different path. And there's so much of his work to draw on that if you take a different path, there's other texts that you can go through. And there's a huge amount of secondary literature in addition to Hansen, of commentators from many, many different disciplines who have provided their own analyses of Benjamin. And so I'm kind of drawing on them as well. So, yeah, there's more to be said. I mean, the other thing about Benjamin that is important is that he died in 1940 at the probably at the hands of the fascists. It's very difficult to know, but the story is that he committed suicide while escaping Europe because he believed that he was going to be arrested and deported the next morning. So it's a kind of a mysterious death, but it's become a kind of a figure for, you know, thinking through the terrors of that time, but also living through it. Really, I mean, he could have left Europe earlier. Supposedly, there's conflicting stories, but he he stayed too long, basically.
Yeah, that's from some of the little bit of reading I tried to do to give myself a little bit of understanding, was that clearly he was caught up in that period, that terrible period where a lot of artists and other intellectuals, if they were especially of German descent or German, found themselves being considered enemies of the state, so to speak, to put it any other way. And unfortunately, it sounds like he was definitely an example of that.
Yes.
So,
yeah, he's an interesting figure for our times now. I mean, he's just a very omniscient kind of figure right now.
So the book, the subtitle, it talks about him and archival film practices. Obviously, we're talking a very theoretical concept as far as it, because that's, you know, he was writing, you know, the type of writing he did. But mm-hmm. I'm assuming that there are ways that you can take what he wrote in your studies and bring it into actual film work that's been created or has actually been made. And you talk a little bit about some specific filmmakers in your book. Can you give us some examples of ways in which your study of his work has helped you make some discoveries within film?
Well, make some discoveries, I guess. I don't know if I discovered anything, to be honest. I've written about some filmmakers that I find that his ideas enable me to look at their films in a new light and a kind of a critical light, and to explore what they're doing. And there's quite a number of filmmakers, a range of filmmakers that are discussed in the book. For example, there's a German director called Gustav Deutsch, and I did not discover him. He's very well known.
No, I guess you're right. I'm using that word incorrectly. I guess what I'm saying that new insights, how's that? Some
exactly.
insights.
Yeah. And Deutsch has made many, many films over many years, and he has some really interesting kind of collaborations with film archives, official archives like the Netherlands Archive and the Vienna Archive and so on. And they open up their doors to him, and he's able to go in and work through. They've got, you know, cans and cans and cans, hours and hours and hours of footage, you know, of films that were shot during the silent period by filmmakers who traveled the world. And where, you know, what's happening with these films, you know, without a context, nobody's going to watch them. And yet it's important that we have those records and we have those documents of what the world looked like, and what those kinds of exchanges were between cameramen and people in different parts of the world. And so Deutsch, basically extracts images from those films and puts them together into new films. So he has a huge oeuvre. I only really write about one of his pieces, which is called World Mirror Cinema, and that was made in 2005. It's really quite remarkable how he uses this material and gives us insights into three different cities in the silent period, roughly between 1910 and 1930. How does Benjamin help us to understand this? Let me see. Benjamin's own work also worked this way. Sometimes, like his famous book, The Arcades Project, was developed by sitting in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris and actually copying out fragments of the things that he read. And he made an archive. He made his own archive, in a sense, with filing cards. And he organized these into sets. And this collection of fragmented texts, became the work that we now call the Arcades Project, which is a study of 19th century Paris. And so his methodology was very much a matter of quotation. And through those quotations sewn together, he's creating a very different perspective on the life and times of Paris. And part of his objective in the Arcades Project was to say that there was a kind of a missed opportunity. Modernity was a missed opportunity, that there was so much promise in the new technologies, and there was a lot of revolutionary discourse and talk going on about a new society that could be brought about with these new technologies. And yet, by the 20th century, very clearly, it was not to be. It was all lost. And he's writing very specifically in Paris during the 30s, during the Nazi occupation. So when we take those kinds of ideas and think about what is Deutsch doing, he's looking back at these old films. He's quoting them and extracting them. And one arguably gets the same kind of impression about the potential of modernity in these cities. Like, I think the cities that are documented in World Mirror Cinema are Vienna, Porto in Portugal, and Soriana in Indonesia. And sort of thinking through what technology meant for these communities and there's a very strong sense of its potential for social transformation. Just that's a kind of a subtle way of looking at it, but that's certainly one of the effects. And we know now, especially in a place like Suriana, Indonesia, that that potential has really failed to bring about a completely transformed, socially equal kind of society.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So one of the things you talk about early on, and we mentioned it briefly going by at the beginning, the concept of found footage. And even though one of the points you make is that you're not really, that's not your point. That's not what you're trying to write about is that concept. But it you do sort of indicate there are some aspects of it that are somewhat related to the concept, even though I would think most people would understand it. Let's real quickly, how would you define found footage film, a found footage film as a concept?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's found footage is still, I think, of interest, and probably you could call a film like World Mirror Cinema an example of found footage. It conventionally means the reworking of old footage shot by other people, mostly, but not always, reassembling it into a new film. And the canonical example of a found footage filmmaker was Bruce Conner. And he allegedly found scraps of film in garbage bins outside studios, for example, outtakes. And I do write about Morgan Fisher, who also worked this way often, working on the margins of the film industry and finding the bits and pieces that are thrown out and reusing them, sewing them together to make an experimental film. And but there's many types of found footage. I wrote a book a long time ago, which I didn't mention. One of the first things that I wrote when I was a graduate student is on a Canadian filmmaker named David Rimmer. And David Rimmer, like many filmmakers in the 70s, would take fragments of old films and rework them under the optical printer so that he would kind of take them apart and just use a few frames and loop them over and over and over again and really kind of work with the celluloid and with the patterns that are endemic in just a one shot of film. And there are definitely still filmmakers around who are into that practice. So, I mean, found footage simply, I mean, most basically means making films without a camera, you know, with it using, making it on the editing table, working with sound, working with, you know, editing pieces together, but not going out and shooting one's own footage.
Yeah, I can think of a couple of examples of films that I've seen that probably would fall into the category that are a little more, I don't want to use the word conventional, but I think it for me, and the one example I can think of is a documentary called The Atomic Cafe.
Which, exactly.
I mean, there's an example. There's no narration. Every word is from the actual films. There are some films where they start a little bit before. I can think of one footage of Harry Truman where they first show him laughing, and then suddenly he talks about the nuclear bomb, and so I could see that as completely built on other materials, even though they're all interrelated. The filmmakers made a completely different film based on the material they put together.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a great example, and we could even call that an example of archivology. I'm not using the term to kind of make boundaries.
Right.
Atomic Cafe is a found footage film. This example of archivology, it might also be called an essay film, because it is very essayistic. It has a point to make, but it, as you say, it does not use narration to make that argument. It uses strictly found footage.
But obviously that's more documentary. When we talk about narrative films, obviously I would think that documentaries and experimental films would be a little bit more obvious ways of using found archivology material. Can you give me an example of a narrative film that would be falling into the category of the material you're talking about?
Let me just think. I shouldn't say no. I'm sure somebody's done it.
No, that's okay. I mean, I just wondered if you had something in mind. Sorry.
No, it's more like, I mean, there is what I'm calling the essayistic. So a film like Tom Anderson's Los Angeles Plays Itself, which is made up of films that were shot in Los Angeles, and he has a voiceover narration, and he has the story to tell, and it's all about how the film industry has stolen the city that I live in. But it's a fabulous film with many, many, many excerpts of films that were shot in Hollywood. But it's one, and he encourages us to look at the backgrounds of these shots rather than the foregrounds, and look at the architecture that is used, and look at the neighborhoods that are used, et cetera, et cetera. It's not a narrative fiction, but it is does tell a story. And that's why the term essayistic comes in handy. I also comment in the book briefly on the work of Ken Burns,
right,
which is also always based on archives. And he always has a story to tell as well, you know. I mean, I'm a little bit critical of Ken Burns, because it often seems like the images are in service to his narrative rather than vice versa.
Right.
But he's also using found footage. He's using archives. In fact, Ken Burns has access to many of the archives of American history that I think a lot of filmmakers would love to get their hands on. But he's sort of got the stamp of approval from, you know, Heritage USA, that he's only going to say nice things about American history. But it's another example. But yeah, I wouldn't. Yeah. So it's a kind of a blur between the experimental and the documentary, in which fiction, narrative cinema plays a role, but only in its cut up form. So in Los Angeles Plays Itself, you do get excerpts from many, many, you know, famous narrative films, like The Player is one that figures prominently, Double Indemnity, Dragnet, science fiction films, and so on. They figure prominently in Tom Anderson's film, but not as full-fledged narratives, only in the excerpts.
Right. Yeah, I agree with you about Burns. You can just about everything he's done, you can watch it, you can make good points about it, and then you can sort of go the other direction and say, yeah, but he does this. And the question is, which comes first, his narrative or the material? And it's not always obvious as to where that goes. I mean, he produces incredible amounts of material, but depending on how you look at him, you're talking about on a film level, and obviously historians have their issues with some of the things he's said and done as well, and it's partly related to this whole which came first.
Right. But then his version of history has this kind of authority to it because it appears to be illustrated. And in a way, this is the other side of archivology, is that it can be used for good as well as evil. Not that Ken Burns is evil, but it can kind of illustrate and be used to support arguments that may be questionable and fallacious, you know. Whereas the films that I'm writing about, I find that they're more generated by the images, and the images are allowed. The filmmakers use different tools to allow the images to speak for themselves.
Right, because there's interpretation that you can make using the material, or you can just present it as is, but it's the interpretation that, you know, you have to always consider, whether the interpretation is valid or whether there's more to it than just what you're seeing.
Right, exactly.
So, obviously, this idea of, and you've pointed out it, the idea of using archival material is nothing new. And in fact, it's interesting. We've obviously seen the idea of archivology in the written word, obviously, for a long, long time. So it's interesting to compare to its use in film, where the ideas are the same. You find material and you use it in a different way, or you illustrate using it. But would you say that archivology in a film, is it comparable to the kind of archive work that might have been done in the past in written works and in books and those kind of studies?
Yeah, I would like to think so. I mean, the Arcades project that I mentioned before is the best example of that, and the most kind of famous example of that. The use of quotation, not a lot of writers get away with, Benjamin does add some of his own prose, but at least 75% of that book, The Arcades Project, is not his own writing. It's borrowed, you know, it's copied from other people. And I don't know of a lot of writers who've gone to that extent, like word for word copying. So it is something that lends itself more to cinema and is more longstanding practice in cinema than in literature. One of the examples that I write about in my book is a film called Paris 1900 by a French filmmaker named Nicole Vedrez, and that was released in 1947. And she's using a kind of what was called the compilation film methodology that became prolific during the war to make war films when, newsreels, right? When you went to the cinema to watch a movie, you got a newsreel that was compiled of clips from cameramen that had been taken from all around the world. They'd be like, pushed together and edited together into a compilation. And so she was using that methodology to make her film Paris 1900 in 1947. But yeah, I don't know of other literary, comparisons, actually, now that you mention it.
It's funny, the more we talk about this, the more other films just come to mind that I would think would follow. And so obviously, the more you think about it, as these concepts, the more you suddenly say to yourself, oh, yeah, I have seen films, and this concept isn't completely foreign. It's something that makes sense when you talk about it this way, when you look at it using this idea, these ideas that you've developed or that you've worked with, that suddenly you see it and it suddenly make, oh, well, that makes sense. I mean, uh-huh. That comes from other things, and I can suddenly just start thinking one film after another, and you know that clearly we're put together using these concepts.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, what are your obviously this book just came out, so this has been a major part of your life for recent times. Have you got other things in the works that you're thinking about, or is it more of a matter that you're still ruminating or using your classes to come up with some other ideas, or are you continuing to work on these kind of concepts related to some of the material you've worked out in the book?
Well, yes. I mean, I do feel like I have. There's a lot more to say about archivology, and finishing the book was maybe like an arbitrary point, because continues to interest me for sure. And I'm hoping to work a little bit more on some Canadian archives and Canadian filmmakers, and trying to zero on a little bit more into specific archives and their specific uses in some upcoming projects. And so that will continue for sure. And I'm going to continue teaching courses on this topic, because it's a really fun thing to teach, and I think the students love it. And there's always new things to say and new things to learn, going backwards, going forwards, looking around us in what archivology can mean. And in addition, I do have a new project that I'm just getting going on, which is kind of surprising, but it may sound surprising, but to me it's not, which is a work on an American actress called Barbara Stanwyck. Mm. And I've been thinking about this for a long time. I really do would like to write a book about her career. And I see it this project as kind of a parallel or a sequel to my book on Japanese film, which was about women's films. The director I wrote about, Natase, he specialized in women's films. And I found that, you know, with Stanwyck, I'm interested in her career and her persona and her contribution to Hollywood. I really think she should be considered as a kind of an auteur in terms of what she contributed, and she did not have a lot of agency, but with the little agency that she did have, I think she made a big difference and is responsible to some extent for what we know classical Hollywood to be. But I'm also interested in tracing the different roles that she played over the course of her career, and how, what kind of story that tells about women in America, women through, like, her career, you know, starts in 1930, and her last film was 1985 or 86 with The Thornbirds, which was a miniseries. So she was in silent film. She was on Broadway as a chorus girl and made silent films, and ended her career making a TV miniseries, which is a quite impressive arc. And I'm actually teaching a course right now on her. And once again, I'm learning every day from my students, and from trying to tell this kind of story of her career that includes so many different genres and so many different kind of types of women that she played over the course of her career that correspond in really interesting ways to changes in American society and American attitudes towards women and roles of women in society, et cetera.
Yeah, it's funny because you think about, I mean, nowadays, at least here in the United States, we have a number of television stations, that local television stations that show old television shows and occasional movies. For some people, the only thing they probably know Barbara Stanwyck for was The Big Valley, her TV series. And,
yes.
And yet, as you point out, her career goes a lot, you know, goes back so far that there's a lot there. And that's good to hear because, as I say, I've been, you know, in doing my interviews, I've interviewed a number of writers who have written about what we would call the older filmmakers and actors. And so it's great that that you've felt that it's worth looking into one of the females during that period and to show what their contribution was.
Yeah, because the thing is, there were very few directors, and so, but that doesn't mean that women were not there and they didn't have a role to play. And already, I think Stanwyck's name is used, for example, on TV broadcasts like TCM has, you know, regular series of Stanwyck movies, and so her, you know, as a brand, I think it's kind of part of the way retrospectives are designed, as much around actors as around directors. And so we should start thinking about that as kind of an organizing principle for how we think about Hollywood history, as a way of kind of sidestepping the question of the auteur. Not that she didn't work with some great auteurs and she didn't learn a lot from them, and maybe they learned from her. In fact, I think they did.
Well, that's great. So hopefully that will come about in the not too distant future, and certainly we can talk about that book if when you, I've been lucky enough to interview some writers more than once when they've written other things. So certainly, when it gets that far, we'll hope, you know, maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that. But hopefully, people will reach out for this book. One of the things that I noticed in reading it was, it's much, you know, the theoretical aspect of it can be, for some people, that can be a little bit daunting. But I really think that you are able to present a number of examples and a number of ways of looking at things that the whole concept of archivology and its importance in film came through quite well.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm finding that the book I mentioned before, Experimental Ethnography, again, it sounds like so theoretical, but I've been told, you know, by many independent filmmakers who are not necessarily into reading critical theory, that they've enjoyed it and they find it useful, which is, I find, very flattering. And I hope that my work can be of interest to people who are not simply film scholars and film theorists, because I did try to write it so it wouldn't be too dense.
Well, thanks again for taking the time. I'm hoping that people will look for the book and hopefully getting a chance to listen to you talk about it in more detail, and your concepts will definitely help that. And overall, I really want to appreciate tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
My great thanks to Catherine Russell for her time, and I hope you find her book to be both interesting and informative. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network.